Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
December 7th, 2014, episode number 70, Lest We Forget. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. This is Kevin England. Today is December 7th, 2014, and we give pause to remember the events from December 7th, 1941, long understood as a date which will live in infamy. Out of respect for that statement, we take a moment to remember those who were lost from the attack on Pearl Harbor. While I can't recall having any direct personal connection to the events of that day, there are certainly many who were impacted, and for them we take a moment to remember and reflect, and also to give thanks to those who have and continue to sacrifice for our freedoms. The calendar has crossed into December, and for this household, it is a period where we look forward to the holidays and some anticipated downtime. Danny will be home from school, and we have a few family things planned, and this is truly a welcome time of year. I enjoy this time of year, as it's a period where I can decompress, spend time with family, lounge around the house, and get to work on some of the projects that I would love to do, but rarely have the spare cycles that they afford. Of course, some of those things include beekeeping activities, and I have a few things lined up for spring preparations and getting organized. I have a bad habit of letting my vacation days go unused for work sometimes, but taking off can be disruptive, and I find that for every day I take off, there are 2 days of punishment making up for what you missed when you were out. I guess many would say this is a foolish notion, but c'est la vie. I was successful in sneaking a day off recently, much to my team's chagrin, and I have lined up a number of them through the upcoming weeks before the year comes to a close. My group always has an end-of-year rush where everybody is trying to spend whatever money they have left over in their budgets. I think we have somewhere around 12 to 16 projects running in parallel right now. And it's disruptive to be out, but hey, it's the holidays and people will have to learn to chill. I could share some commentary of my time off activities recently, but I'll leave that for the local hive report. Let me stay on task and give you a taste of what we have to share in this episode. For segment number one, we're going to give an update on the fight against varroa mites. This time we'll talk about a biological approach using fungus. Yep, fungus. Segment number two will preview the rose hive approach that originates from Ireland. And segment number three will talk about the dimensions and concepts of a golden mean hive and the logarithmic spirals. Then for the roundtable, we'll tee up the following items. We'll circle back on the topic and answer a question about hive monitoring. We'll share some happenings at the Wee Bit Apiary and what John Ike has been up to. An overview of the use of oxalic acid for mite control. A report from listener Clive Tebbett. We'll let you know where you can get a sneak peek at our new website prototype. And there will be a few more odds and ends along the way. So first up, the local hive report. I seem to recall mentioning that I recently completed 2 new BK Corner version 2 hive stands for the bee yard. This past week, I took a spare one that I had and was ready to deploy, and one of the 2 that I created, and pulled 2 of the hives off the rails that they were resting on and set them on individual stands out in the bee yard. I have 2 more stands ready to go and 2 more hives that need the same thing, and then I can eliminate the rails and return them to their original purpose, which is for stacking firewood on. I don't particularly like hives on rails, and if you're not following what I mean by that, I'm referring to setting 2 8-foot-long 4x4 posts on a few cinder blocks and then lining the hives up next to each other. There are pros and cons to this approach, but I find that I personally like to have my hives in a manner which I can walk around them and not be encumbered by having other hives in the way. I do like that I could set things on the hive next to it while I'm working a hive, but the cons of this setup for me outweigh the pros, and I'm looking to get each hive on an individual stand and spaced with some distance between them. In a small way, I think this might help with drift from hive to hive, but my hives are only about 4 to 5 feet apart from each other, and I would think they have to be 10, 20, maybe even 30 feet apart to negate drift, but that's another topic for another time. So I ran out of time and didn't get to deploy the final two, so I'll be doing that in the upcoming weekend. I also had some equipment sitting out on a table in the bee yard and needed to do some tidying up. In the open, I mentioned that I had a day off from work, and one of the things I did was clean up my bee equipment storage area in the garage and organize things a bit. I pulled things off the stack and then returned everything back to a more organized fashion. I put things that I know I'll need in the spring on the top of the stack, and items that I'm not likely to use at the bottom. I keep the feeders with the feeders, the queen excluders with the queen excluders, and the spare roofs and bottom boards with the spare roofs and bottom boards. I'm sure you get the picture. So the garage is tidy, and now I have a plan to focus on the projects that I want to do for spring. Three main things are on the project list: build another top bar hive, build two queen castles, and build two quiet boxes. I'm also contemplating building a few more hive stands for expansion, but don't tell Sharon. Well, you could tell Sharon if you want. I'm sure she will sympathize with me and be okay with that. So the local hive report takes a turn this time of year as we take a bit of a break on what's actually going on with the bees, because they're kind of nested in, and we focus on our indoor activities. I have peeked periodically on the hives out in the yard, and so far everyone's still flying, but it's early days in the winter. We'll keep our fingers crossed and dream of spring. So I had one side note that I wanted to sneak in here for the episode before we get started. I wanted to give a shout out to the Mueller family from Missouri and wish Greg a happy birthday. Seems beekeeping is a central activity there, and our effort is part of the fabric of life, and for that we are humbly honored. To Lisa, thanks for sharing the photos. Are priceless, and Sharon loved the cupcake idea and thought they were spectacular. I wish everyone the best, and a happy holiday season, including the young lady who loves to hate beekeeping, and welcome you to keep in touch and let us know how you're doing. So speaking of keeping in touch, let me share a few contact items in case you want to reach out to us. Our website is www.bkcorner.org or .com, either will work. You can send an email with comments, questions, and suggestions for episode topics to Kevin at bkcorner.org. And you can follow us in between episodes on Facebook at facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. I would venture that most of our listeners are not the Twitter type, but if you are, you can follow along there too. My Twitter handle is Kevans, K-E-V-V-A-N-S, Kevan being my nickname through life, and on my license plate for my truck. Yeah, okay, enough of that. Time to get this part started. Let's roll with segment number one. Segment number one, biological varroa control treatment. There isn't a day that goes by where I don't poke my head out into the world and look for something newsy related to the bees. That being the case, there are not many ideas or information about beekeeping that I haven't seen or have had visibility to. Of course, the Dunning-Kruger effect would say that I'm wrong, but I'll leave it at that and stay on task. Once upon a time, I came across some insight about trying to combat the varroa mite problem by messing with its reproductive cycle. I sometimes can't tell you what my name is, but stuff like that is rattling around somewhere in my steel trap. So the source of this information, as I recall, was in 2012. And it was mentioned in one of the scientist reviews from the EAS event in Hershey. And knowing me, I had my recorder and could probably go back and find the actual reference. But again, I'll work to stay on task about this article. There was some recent coverage of an innovation for varroa mite control using a biological, eco-friendly approach which manipulates the sexual behavior of the mites. Okay, let's stay G-rated here. It's a science thing, after all. Researchers from the University of Hanheim, Germany, developed a technique whereby they disrupt the mating process of the male mites by using chemical pheromones to disturb the male's mating with the female mites in the cell. If we follow how mites reproduce, the female varroa mite enters the brood cell of a developing worker just before it's capped, and during the bee's gestation, she lays multiple eggs. It is typical for one male and up to three females to develop from these eggs. During the bee's incubation time, the mites will mature, and prior to emergence, the male will mate with the females in order to propagate the species. When the bee emerges, the mites will emerge with it, and the cycle will start all over again. For this innovation, researchers have found a way to isolate and extract mite pheromones for use as the biological agent to disrupt the reproductive cycle. They do this by confusing the male via spraying extracted mite pheromone on the brood cells. The result is the male ineffectively mates the female mite, or she doesn't get mated at all. Findings show that the females are often mated at the wrong time, and specifically when they are not mature yet, which results in ineffective mating. Messing up the timing results in fewer sperm transferred, and this impacts the ability for the female to create further female eggs. Net-net, fewer female eggs, lower mite population. Cool. Yes. This could have viability to become a commercial product, given that the source article indicates that it's relatively inexpensive, said to be harmless to humans, and leaves no residue in the bee products. So I know of another study going on from Dr. David Chandler from the University of Warwick. He's looking on various fungi to impact the varroa but do not pose a threat to the honeybees. That work was going on from 2008, and I'm not sure where it lies at this time. There was interest in that study, and there was actually a website up talking about that, and the page indicates at the time that they were looking for funds. Not sure what's going on with that. The way that approach was theorized to work is to use a biological microorganism common in the environment, which are pathogenic organisms. These organisms would work by producing spores that impact the hive and the varroa, but not the bees, and be able to survive in that environment, which is different, as you may gather, from the typical outside environment, not maintained by tens of thousands of insects. In other words, introducing something into the bee ecosystem is touchy business. Fungi organisms might not live or do well in that environment, even if we want it to be true. The fundamental approach here is that the fungi spores would grow on the cuticle of the mite, think the outer shell, and multiply until it takes over the mite and ruins it. Struggles include finding the right fungi and finding methods to apply them. In the study, they were talking about providing the equivalent of a foot bath at the hive entrance, which the bees would walk across and transfer the product into the hive. If the foot bath method doesn't work out, the hive could have other options, such as impregnated paper that the bees come in contact with, because the bees love to chew paper to get rid of it, and that would be the method of transference. They even talked about powders and granulated delivery. The fungi we're talking about, of course, would be ones that would already be found in the environment, but scientists would grow it in larger quantities and then introduce it to impact the mites so that it will be in higher concentrations inside the hive. There is, of course, a lot of work to be done on these ideas, but I would give the obligatory caution that we hope we are not in a fix-one-break-two pattern and messing up the ecosystem in the hive or introducing an unnatural balance into the hive environment. Here's a Kevin moment. This reminds me of something that Michael Bush talks about often, which is how we've likely messed up the ecology of the microbes inside the hive because of the way that we manage them, and also with the introduction of chemicals and other things that we do. Perhaps this is a silly notion, scientists working with fungi, but perhaps they'll strike gold and find that missing balance while they're poking around. Hopefully this will become fruitful. But better that they test this very well, because I think this is really disconcerting to me. What are the chances we're going to get this right? I really think that you got to be careful with messing with nature here. End of Kevin moment. So I think, like a lot of concepts, there's a lot of work to do here, and we've talked about the past, about the difficulties and hurdles of transferring a good idea into a viable business model that would lead to commercialization. I tend to be squeamish about this, but think the choice of chemicals or natural existing fauna from nature, it's more plausible, but there's probably some scientists out there who could convince me that I'm a fool. Don't worry about the monetary thing. This is a doable deal. Either way, all we hope for is a way out, but please don't give us something that we'll regret later. So before we go, I'll make one more mention. There was a varroa mite attractants study going on by Mark Carroll from the Carl Hayden Bee Research Center out of Tucson. I know that in cooperation with Gainesville, Florida, and Peter Thiel, I think I have this connection right, remember the line in the pan guy, they were also looking at volatile odors from the hive and looking to see if there was an avenue here. So there's a lot of different people working this problem, and we can only hope that somebody's going to strike pay dirt. If you can get to the varroa mite without nuking them with an insecticide, but finding some novel approach, that'd be an interesting thing. I guess in the end, I still root for the fact that if we just be patient, eventually the bees and the varroa mite will come to some compromise, because it doesn't make sense to me that the varroa mite is going to completely wipe out the European honeybee. They have to learn to work together, or what good is this to the varroa mite overall? Time will tell, I guess. So as is the norm for each of our episodes, if you want to learn more about this or see the source articles, you can check out our webpage, www.bkcorner.org. Go to the show notes for episode number 70. You'll see a link to Fungus Foot Bats Could Save Bees. And the other one is Innovation Effective Biological Varroa Mite Treatment. And I'll look to see in that Mark Carroll presentation that I have if I could find a link for that one too. Okay, moving on. For segment number two, I want to talk about rose beehives. A question came our way about these beehives that have an origin in Ireland. I have looked in on this before and I'm watching it with interest. Let me see if I could do justice by describing what is the rose hive experience and why I like it and why I think it's appealing. A primer on the rose hive starts with a beekeeper in Ireland named Tim Rowe. Tim hails from West Cork, which incidentally is home to the project manager that I have on my team at work, so I know where that is. Southern central tip or thereabouts of Ireland. Tim has a website, rosebeehives.com, where he outlines his program. The website and program are simple, basic, and well orchestrated. He explains what a rose hive is, he provides videos on how to construct them, and he goes over simple principles of the design he's supporting and the whole notion with the content Beyond Beekeeping. What I mean about Beyond Beekeeping is evident in the video section of his website and his YouTube page. Tim is a craftsman and a handyman and appears to operate a small commercial beekeeping operation and farm with his family. Well, I presume it's his family. Anyway, let me see if I could do the hive principle some justice. So the first thing, let me describe the hive system. It's a simple bottom board, one type of hive body and a roof. That's a simplified description, but good enough. The hive is designed with what appears to be 2-inch planks making up the front and back facing boards and standard plywood thickness boards for the sides. He has a video on the site that goes over the construction techniques he uses to cut the handholds and the frame rests and everything in the planks. And then the sides are just screwed on to create the box. He goes through tips about how to square the box and other things like that. You could tell from a visual standpoint, he's a craftsman. They're well worth the time and demonstrate how well thought out the design is. And you can see exactly how they're constructed. They do not employ finger joints or multiple size dimension boxes. He has standardized on one dimension for the box, and the trade-offs are worth the flexibility and enable him to use the deployment method to his likings and the ways of keeping bees, which are outlined in a presentation on his site. Every box is 18 1/8 inch by 18 1/8 inch square. It's the same dimension, apparently, as a common European national and commercial hive with one difference, the depth of the box. All of the boxes are 7.5 inches deep or 190 millimeters. By contrast, and keep in mind I have no practical experience with these types of hives, so I had to look it up, a standard national hive is 150 millimeters deep for a shallow super, 225 millimeters for a medium, and a full box is 315 millimeters. For us non-metric system users, the deep translates to about 13 3/4 inch depth. So his box is just larger than a standard national super, and to me this is the functional equivalent to an all-medium hive. For comparison, a U.S. Langstroth medium is 6 5/8 inch, and a rose hive is about 7.5 inches. The length and width comparison are about equal, as a Langstroth box is 19 7/8 by 16 1/4, and if you squared that up, you'd be pretty darn close. In the end, this box is, for all intent and purposes, a tick larger in dimension than a Langstroth medium. There's one thing to call out here, and that is that the square dimensions accommodate more frames than a typical Langstroth hive. This is 12 frames in a box. And by visiting the website, it looks like in the videos, these are frames that he makes directly for his boxes. So there is a reason for going through all this math, and it is this. Perhaps the one thing I could see immediately is the feedback on the weight of a full box. The trade-off of not using smaller supers or boxes bigger than a traditional medium that we're used to in the U.S. is weight. However, I could say that from an efficiency standpoint, those few extra inches make sense as it provides a more face square footage on the frame, and stacking four boxes is equivalent to one deep and four mediums in a Langstroth parlance. Let me say that in another way. One of the knocks have been on an all-medium hive is the fact that the shortness of the depth of the frame creates a lot of waste inside the entire cavity because you have the top bar and the bottom bar, and they're taking up square footage that could be comb face if you had used just one larger, deeper frame. In this case, he's actually remediating that because his boxes are a little different. So the supporting information on the website seems pretty sufficient and simply explained. There's a presentation on the management options and how his hive system works for him. In the spring, when a box is in a two-hive configuration and growing, he adds a box in the middle of the stack to allow for brood expansion and presumably to thwart swarm impulses. So picture that. He's two boxes in the stack. Instead of putting a box on top, he lifts the top box and puts another one in the middle and allows for the brood chamber to expand through three boxes. Somewhere during the season, as the flow is on, if he wants to add another box, he adds it in the number two position. Second from the bottom, and it's pretty much nadiring, which we talked about on our last episode, but it doesn't impact the box on the bottom board. If you want to swap out old brood comb, early in the spring he swaps the boxes, and then as he's putting boxes in through the middle, the oldest box is coming to the top. They're putting honey in that. He extracts the honey. He melts the wax. To me, it's kind of like what I've heard for using not a Langstroth hive, but the Waré hive, in that you under super and you're pulling boxes off the top to harvest honey. If he wants to make a split, fine. You take the top box off and set it aside. And with the walkaway split, one of the boxes has a queen and the other one will raise one. Or he can add one if he so desires. They're all the same boxes, so there's no muss, no fuss. And it's pretty ingenious in its simplicity and execution. As he puts it, simpler, cheaper, and healthier. It seems to me that this is a simple hobby beekeeper who decided to build his own stuff, to build it with a practical application in mind, and came up with something that hit on all the right notes. He became successful and then deployed a program around this. He wrote a book. But this is all strictly speculation for me. I don't know. This is just me looking in. I say bravo for him. His book is there to explain the method even further, and he's selling hives through a local distributor. He's created videos in support of the program, and they exude his common sense approach, and he seems to be well produced. Again, bravo for him. He's even produced some other beekeeping operation videos, such as harvesting honey and melting wax, that are very informative and help to support the program, and has, as I've said earlier, a YouTube channel covering these and other exploits of the show. So Kevin Momick, guess what I did during Thanksgiving? Poked around on his website. That's how I know all of this. I am not an expert by any means. So if you're interested in seeing the visuals of what I've described, take some time and visit the website at rosebeehives.com. I exchange emails with Tim about what he produced, and my take is that he's put the information out there for others to have, and he will sell hives and provide insights as need be, but he's not interested in becoming the next Lorenzo Langstroth or getting into philosophical debates about his hive better than, you know, whether it's better than someone else's or not, and the pros and cons, and people complaining about it, and so on. He's simply providing a service to the beekeeping community and selling a few hives while he's at it. That's my read on his email response. I offer up a heartfelt thank you for all the time and energy he's given to giving back to the beekeeping community, and offer him the best of luck on his farm and his commercial operation that he uses to sustain his livelihood. Good for him. Segment number three is the golden mean. I mentioned in episode 67 to Bob Kloss that I was interested in putting together another top bar from parts in my garage, and we discussed the golden mean concept. I spent a small amount of time looking to see if I could figure out what this was and ended up with a dead end. I couldn't find plans or an explanation, and I speculated that I would have to do this by brute force. Since Bob's new hives are golden mean dimension, it seemed to me to make sense to wander over to his place and take some measurements. Cue up listener Nick Jordan, who is a wealth of information in his own right and seems to know where everything beekeeping is on the web. I mean, every nook and cranny. Nick sent in an image of a catenary-shaped hive that exemplifies the golden mean concept, and also a link to a 3D warehouse that has measurements for the golden mean hive and a couple other hive resources. Nick, to the rescue. The golden mean, or really the golden ratio, is a concept that has applications in architecture, painting, music, design, in a myriad of other ways, but in beekeeping, it is the nature aspect that brings it into focus for this discussion. To avoid getting technical, I will attempt to simplify the notion of the golden ratio as a logarithmic spiral that is predictable and repeatable. This spiral, or even more simplified, is a curve shape with a certain proportion that is found throughout our natural world, and by example, can be discovered when reviewing arrangements of branches on a stem or veins in a leaf. The proportions of a person's body parts in relation to the relative size of the human body is another example. And even at the atomic scale, the foundation of crystalline structures in crystals such as cobalt serve as an example. Scientists and mathematicians have spent centuries making correlations to the golden ratio, and it is said in some respects that we can be harmonious with nature if we build the dimensions into our everyday lives. It is that notion that takes us to the concept of a golden mean hive. It is based upon the fundamental principle that we're providing a cavity that will allow the bees to be harmonious with their environment and providing them the shape by which they can build comb in a vessel that would allow them to construct structures in an ideal setting. I know in the past that I covered this notion, but I'm not quite sure which episode it was. Perhaps a listener can recall where this was discussed in the past and help me out, but it was Nick Jordan coming to the rescue as he triggered the rattling in my head that I shared in the opening segment when he sent me a few links to a golden mean hive plan available on the web and a catenary hive design. Ding, 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 ding. That's what it was. It was the catenary term that I was looking for. So what is catenary? From Wikipedia, it says, quote, "In physics and geometry, a catenary is the curve that an idealized hanging chain or cable assumes under its own weight when supported only at its ends. The curve has a U-like shape, superficially similar in appearance to a parabola, but is not a parabola. It is scaled rotated graph of the hyperbolic cosine. The curve appears in the design of certain types of arches in the cross-section of a catenoid, the shape assumed by a soap film bound by two parallel circular rings." Whoa. Let's talk about this in layman's terms. Catenary, like the golden ratio, is all around us. If you see something draped between two things hanging by its own weight, it is likely a catenary curve. Chain draped between two posts is probably a catenary curve. Sashes draped on a curtain rod, the Golden Gate Bridge cables hanging between the two stanchions. And there are tons of other examples in architecture. So incidentally, the catenary in architecture is a bit different from the one that I'm talking about. By example, think of the St. Louis Arch. If the dimensions were of a string hanging from two points, but you turned it upside down, it would not support the arch. There are different ways to construct catenary curves, and the dimensions of that arch are a bit different than if it were hanging from the earth upside down, as an example. Okay, let me come back to the point of this segment, catenary hives, golden mean hives. They're meant for us to create a perfect cavity for the bees to build comb and to make a home. pleasing and wonderful things will magically happen if we employ the right dimensions. In the case of Golden Mean, the hive image plans that Nick sent me, the dimension of the hive body are roughly 13¾ inch wide by 22 inches deep by 33 inches long. For those in the metric system, it's 350 millimeters wide, 560 millimeters deep, and 838 millimeters long. It's an interesting contrast to compare this to a Langstroth box dimension. A Langstroth is 9⅝ inches deep. A normal brood box would be 2 of these, so we could say the normal height is 19¼ inches high. This box, the Golden Mean box, is 22 inches deep. A Langstroth box is 16¼ inches wide. This one is just short of 14. A normal Langstroth box is just short of 20 inches long. This particular plan is more like a top bar hive style, so it's 33 inches. My guess is you could make it 20 inches if you were so inclined. But I think the expectation of this design is it's a horizontal hive, not something you would stack on top of each other. In summary, the box is a little deeper and a little bit narrower and sits taller than a Langstroth box. I'm not clear if this plan employs a Golden Mean for the length that made it a deep hive or the designer just picked an arbitrary depth. So another thing about these plans, the 3D diagram also had a render of the top bar design for these hives. It was clever in its own right. It had a top bar with two dowels hanging down, and at the bottom of the dowels was a suspended bottom bar. There were no formal sides to the frame, but something hanging down that the bees could scaffold their comb on, which to me looked really smart. It seems this would help the bees build straight comb down in a top bar hive, and not cross comb or build out wonky comb, which happens sometimes. It had a short blurb about the dimension of the dowel that you need to use, and that it should be 6 millimeters or less, otherwise the bees would build around it. The design had a quilt box, and there were other models there to review, so if you're interested, you can go take a look. I think I said that wrong a second ago. 6 millimeters or less, so that the bees will build around it, otherwise they will build alongside of it, is my guess. So in addition to the Golden Hive, and as I mentioned a moment ago, Nick also sent a photo of a catenary hive. This image was more akin to what I was expecting and resembled a half-barrel shape. It would be more like the dimensions of a rope hanging down and that natural arc that would be formed. So Golden Mean or catenary, they're both methods that others have tried. In my case, I'm just looking to build another top bar from some salvage that I picked up, and I knew these concepts and figured this is as good of a place to start as any. I have a premise, given what I know, that there is something to the concepts of how bees build comb in nature. To choose an appropriate shape for the slopes of the top bar that I'm going to make and the depth of the frame. I reason that maybe, and I have no evidence to make me think I'm right, that if the hive is built with a Golden Mean ratio or catenary shape, the bees will build out comb and not attach it to the sides. That somehow, magically, the comb attachment to the top bar and the shape of the comb they will build will be harmonious from a stance that the top bar will be able to hold the weight of the contents of the comb, be it bees or honey. I'll be studying what these plans have to show and learn from them in anticipation of Christmas week and plans to build out some equipment during the layover between the holidays. So as always, Nick, thanks for the assist. Before I close this segment down, I want one more little bonus fact to share with you here. As I came across all these different ratios, one of the things that came up is the shell dimensions that you see with seashells. They're not exactly the golden ratio, but over and over again, the golden ratio is illustrated in textbooks and whatever by looking at seashells and showing the golden ratio over it. But the truth is, shells follow a different logarithmic spiral than the dimensions of a golden mean. They're close, but they're not the same thing dimensionally. So there's a little factoid that you could share with your friends someday in a dinner conversation. As you might expect, there'll be some links in the show notes for catenary hive, golden ratio, and 3D golden hive images and plans. Okay, time to head to the roundtable section of the podcast. Let's go. So it's time for the roundtable section of the podcast. This is the back of the book, so to speak. Just a number of commentary things. So we'll start off with listener mail. This one revisits the topic of hive monitoring. JP from New Zealand wrote in with some comments about some hive monitoring systems that he found on the web, specifically about the ones that are available mostly to commercial beekeepers and how expensive they are. I agree, they are expensive. I guess they're built for research institutes and others that have the money to do this. I guess if I'm a large commercial operation, I can afford to put some of these in if I'm of the technology type. I do know and have covered some suggestions about hive monitoring on the show and some backyard scientists that talk about sensor enabling different hives. In episode 47, titled Bee Bombs, we talked about the SparkFun electronics company that has parts and pieces on order to build a Raspberry Pi mainboard, like a mini computer, which can be affixed with sensors. That notion was taken into completion from coverage of episode 58, where we talked about the work of listener Sean Wilson and what he's doing. He literally has hive sensor kit that he built in operation, and you could follow his metrics live and online. His website was in the show notes for that episode, but I'll share it again in case you missed it. It's twoliddleladiesapiary.com. It seems that Sean is still at it, and not only that, he's taking it further. When I checked in on him last, he was going in that direction. From his homepage, you could see now that he... Actually, I need to make a caveat of this, because if you're listening to it, who knows what the homepage looks like today. But today, as the time of release, there's a prototype of a hive sensor device that shows at a glance whether current temps are suitable for hive inspection. That's a pretty cool use of Internet of Things. It has an LCD screen that displays the current inside and outside temperatures, humidity, barometric pressure, and other information. It's suggested that it might have a stoplight LED indicator that will inform the beekeeper if it's a good temperature and wise to enter. If it is just so-so, you could take your chances, or it would display red if it's too cold for inspections. That's pretty cool stuff. So JP, with the podcast and 18 other things going on, I'm afraid I'm too overloaded to get into the hive sensor construction and programming business. I have a young man who is capable and idealistic, but he's focusing on his proper schoolwork and energies there for the time being. I know of one analog that I'm going to do next year, and that is to put my hive scale out in the yard. Bob Kloss shared with us data he had two episodes ago, and it was really valuable and motivating me to get my scale into service. This thing is literally a platform scale used to measure grain that can go outside. It's built like an Industrial Revolution device. Very hardy and should be fine out there with a hive on it at all times. So for those that are interested and have some discretionary funds, there are systems out there that you can purchase. Solution B is one company from Raleigh, North Carolina, that sells systems that include hive monitoring and phone applications. This system will monitor up to 100 hives and send data through a cell phone network to a web server on the internet for you to access by your telephone, meaning cell phone, or PC. It provides remote reporting and can trigger alarms for various events. For international listeners, there is some hope for some of you. As they say, they service not only the U.S., but parts of Europe, Asia-Pac, and Africa. Another system that's been getting visibility lately is the Arnia one. It has Hive Monitor, a remote gateway, and apps like the previous solution. But this one, you can buy a scale to go with it also, so you always know what your measurements are, your weights. Again, these things are pricey, but perhaps it would be something that maybe an association could go in on for one hive and share the data with the community. Perhaps there could be a state grant somewhere that would buy a number of these and place them throughout the state. I'm getting creative here, of course, but it could be an interesting concept for crowdsourcing something at a state level apiary agency type area. Think of it this way. Many clubs have an extractor that they loan to all of their members. Why not have a hive sensor system that everybody could see the data from? That'd be pretty cool. My guess is, JP, hold out a little hope. With time and some ingenuity, somebody's going to build one of these systems for a fifth of the cost that will trickle down to the homeowners. Maybe you're not going to do it with a gateway or cell phone interface, but maybe you have it on your property and your Wi-Fi can extend out to the area of your bee yard where they could pick up the connectivity and you could cut the cost by losing the gateway component in the cell phone. A circuit board, say Intel or Raspberry Pi or Arduino or something, with a breadboard and a few sensors in a box, and you're in business right in your own homestead. So I'm going to have to needle my oldest again to put his Raspberry Pi into use when he comes home for the holidays. And JP, sorry to say, I don't have much to add to the subject about building your own. I do have one place, however, that you can go and take a peek. It's called openenergymonitor.org. If you go to that website and type in /emon, E-M-O-N, /bmonitor, and of course I'll provide you a link in the show notes for this, you'll see a live hive monitoring system with insights on how it was built and how to source the parts. To me, it didn't look too complicated, and they have the whole thing spelled out there on the site. So you were looking for a resource of where you could potentially find it, go take a look at openenergymonitor.org. That page also shares some links about other systems, hobbies, hobbyist, and commercial, and looks like a good place to a jump off for different forums and things like that. So in the show notes for this segment, you'll find Open Energy Monitor, Bee Monitor, version 1, version 2, a link to that at that webpage, the Solution Bee Commercial Hive Monitoring System, and the Arnia Commercial Hive Monitoring System, along with Open Energy Monitor thing that I just talked about, and the links there that you can find. Roundtable number 2, a check-in from John Ike from the WeeBits Apiary. O-U-I is how we is spelled. I'm assuming that's how it's pronounced. I could be completely and utterly wrong. John shared a local hive report with me early in November, and I had an email exchange with him where I asked how his year went. John's in Virginia, and it seems that he's in a similar situation as we are. His story indicated that hives were good in July, but in need of feed in the fall and late summer due to lack of rain and good forage. He shared his hive prep for the winter with me and seems to be on a good path. During his response, he called out a segment in episode 55 where I apparently shared an epiphany for him about a timed split, and it has helped to be sustainable and feeling good about his prospects. It's always cool enough to get some feedback from listeners who find and make use of the information we're sharing. So John's been with us for a long time and a great supporter of the show, and he's actively sharing stuff with us on his Facebook page. To get there, check out facebook.com/WeeBitsApiary. That's OUIBITS.apiary. He has a ton of shared videos and insights there, and it's certainly worth a look. Keep up the good work, John, and thanks for writing in. And as obligatory, we'll have a link in the show notes if you didn't get that URL because it's a little complicated. Roundtable number 3 is a question on oxalic acid. Lori Bruns wrote in to ask if we've ever covered this on the podcast. The actual answer is not in any detail. We may have mentioned it, but we've not covered it until now. In past episodes, I've shared that I haven't tried it personally, but I do know what it is. I've heard about it from fellow podcaster Gary Fawcett from the beekeeping podcast The Kiwi Mana Buzz. They sell a device in New Zealand, and he sells it personally. It vaporizes oxalic acid, which, if I have it right, comes in a powder form. And Gary has information in a video on the device that he sells on his website for his customers. And I know that he has mentioned on several occasions that they routinely use this for mite control in his bee yards. I've also heard it mentioned from Randy Oliver when he came to speak for the New Jersey Beekeepers Association meeting that we hosted here at North Hunterdon High School. When he was here a few years ago, he talked about the practice of using this like a bleaching agent, which is apparently how it's used in some circles. And if you are, quote unquote, bleaching your frames to clean them up, you're not out of the realm of using this. The fact of the matter is using oxalic acid in the United States is illegal. But there could be means to change that, but let me not get ahead of myself. So you have to think of it this way. Anything that involves vaporization is likely a no-no in the U.S., and especially here in New Jersey, where they are very risk-averse to these type of vaporized acids. Randy Oliver's website has a pretty in-depth topic on this, and it indicates the vapor is highly harmful to your eyes, nose, and lungs, and exposes the beekeeper to significantly more risk of serious injury than the dribble method that they use. So what exactly is it and how does it work? In short, oxalic acid is a vaporized product and it changes from a solid to vapor, or I should say as it changes from a solid to a vapor, it decomposes into formic acid and carbon monoxide. Formic acid, of course, is something that kills mites and is used on several products in the market, including Mite Away Quick Strips. Randy has some detailed and highly recommended articles on the subject at his site, scientificbeekeeping.com, and I would suggest that's the first place to start. One note is that it's a two-part coverage, and I'm pretty much looked at the second part, where they're talking about working methods to make it legal in the United States, and the key to this is the focus on a measured delivery in a safe manner. It comes this way. If you can control the delivery in a manner that doesn't expose us, and you can control the amount delivered to the hive, that's the optimal application of this. There's a sidebar in his article about Dr. Medhat Nasser, someone I met in Hershey. And he's a well-respected bee researcher from Canada, and Dr. Nasser has developed a vaporizer that uses a metered dose via a pill that is said not to overheat the acid, which causes it to break down and be ineffective. So that's another side effect of this, is when you melt this powder or vaporize it, so to speak, you have to do it in a controlled means that releases the formic acid without boiling it off, is my guess. So, you know, it's a time for a word of caution on this, because anytime I say these things, people could potentially get the notion. On one hand, you have people in New Zealand, Europe, Canada, and other regions using this successfully. On the other hand, we don't have practical experience with it in the United States, nor do we have a legal means of applying it. At minimum, I would suggest you should read what Randy has to say, as he has more insights than what I've shared with you here about the applications and the hazards of the products that you want to read if you're messing around with this stuff for some reason. But I would suggest to you, As much as this sounds like a conservative U.S. approach, which is not something we usually say when compared to the rest of the world, given they all think we're very flippant about these things, wait for somebody to come out with a commercial product that you can administer and you're not going to burn your lungs up. I'll provide a few links in the show notes, and thanks for Lauren. Thanks to Lauren for writing in. Hopefully this was a reasonable primer on the topic. So before I close this roundtable section down, let me just provide one common sense thing. Oxalic, O-X-A-L-I-C, in case you want to go look that up and you don't know how to spell it. For roundtable number four, just a short public service announcement, I wanted to make mention that we posted a few new videos on the NWNJBA YouTube channel. One video is a short about bees defending a hive. There's another one about a watering bucket and using corks as the floaters. There's a third one there with some commentary about hosting a plant swap that I've spoken about on the episode a couple back. Last but not least, I've finished the feature on making creamed honey that I've talked about here. You could see the video version of that. All of them are short, less than 10 minutes in duration, videos to get you in and out. 200 plus videos over there, so go take a look. It's a good time also in the winter time for those of us in the U.S. who are on down period to go do your little bit of research, go read a book, find some things, and there's a lot of interesting videos beyond our channel at YouTube. And if you look at the subscriptions that we have, hopefully there's nothing clandestine there, you can jump off from the Northwest channel and go see some other interesting beekeeping channels that we peek at all the time. Link for that is youtube.com/NWNJBA. Roundtable number five brings us to another listener mail, this one from Clive Tebbett. Clive hails from the Yarra Valley, just east of Melbourne, Australia. He has two hives and is just starting out. He's following the footsteps of several of our listeners that I've known from the past and listening through the entire catalog of shows. That seems like a fun thing to do, I suppose, and I've done it once myself, kind of like stepping back through a time capsule. Clive described his surroundings in his email, and it sounds like Eden to me. No varroamites, no bears, no skunks, no snow, no monoculture crops nearby. Generally, it's small acreage residential with pasture land down in the valley and bush, a.k.a. forest to the hills. That's how he wrote in his description. He has wineries in the vicinity, but apparently they're out of reach of his bees. So unfortunately, it can't all be perfect that he's dealing with temperatures on occasion of 110 degrees Fahrenheit on some days. And I'd say that's pretty hot for even for bees. He sent along a few photos of his hives, and he has a post and fence type setup around his hives with a tarp, it looks like. I'm just interpreting what I saw, that gives them a bit of shade. The valley in the home looks very picturesque, and I especially like the citrus tree in the foreground in one of the shots. I can't tell if there's lemons or oranges, but it seems very exotic. There's one close-up of a hive entrance with some bees coming and going along with the email. The bees look interesting, what I can make out of them. They seem mostly dark with some golden hues along the thorax. And one of the girls is very, very loaded with pollen on the landing board. I say well done, Clive, and thanks for taking the time to write in. So two more things to get into before we get to our closing comments. Roundtable number six, wanted to share a sneak peek with our new website prototype. We put up the NJ Swarm website to capture the New Jersey Swarm Report. It's a WordPress blog, and I had mentioned in past episodes that I'm looking to migrate my current website, which is very manual and all built from scratch, to something more blog-like so I could focus more attention and give a better delivery and accounting. I've been working on the transformation with the expectation that going into the new year, we'll switch to the new website. I have all the podcast episodes loaded in to the new one, and I'll switch the URL probably over the holidays. You could take a sneak peek at this if you go to bkcorner.njswarm.com, and you'll see the prototype we have up and working. One of the neat things about the features is that I've gone through and rebuilt the show notes for every episode in a common format, all consistent look and feel, and I've been able to tag each episode with its content. And you could use a tag cloud and also search on specific topics if you know what they are, or you could just browse them. I've also been able to categorize the different posts, and as we put new videos up on the YouTube channel, or we post show notes for each episode, or we do public events or things like that, we can break those out and give you exposure. So more like a blog roll of what's going on. It'll augment and or complement, I think, the Facebook page that we have. The Twitter feed is in there and a couple other things. So if you want to check that out, bkcorner.njswarm.com. And again, we'll switch www.bkcorner.org over to that sometime over the holidays. I have one last technical hurdle, or I would have switched it already, which is figuring out how to migrate all the audio files and video content that's on the current site to the new hosting. There's a size limitation, and I have to work with my provider, but I'm pretty sure we can get past that. So look for the new site announcement. Maybe it won't have to wait until the holidays, but I think that's probably the likely time frame to make the conversion. Any feedback on that prototype of things you'd like to see or things you like, let us know. Just send over an email or leave a comment on our Facebook page. There's a note over there announcing this. So roundtable number 7, I wanted to introduce a new feature to the website. Every once in a while, I thought it would be interesting to just throw out a bee-themed quote that's available out in the world. I found a website that had a number of these quotes at goodreads.com. I was looking for this, and I'll just share this one to top off the episode. This one's attributed to Abraham Lincoln. Quote, "I don't like to hear cut and dried sermons, no. When I hear a man preach, I like to see him act as if he were fighting bees." Unquote. I like that. So I guess that's going to wrap it up for this one. I have a stack already set up for episode number 71. I have a couple closing comments. Today is the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association, our local association's holiday get-together. Looking forward to doing that. It's a potluck dinner, and we do a little Chinese auction, and going to have elections. It's always a good event. Really enjoy that. And it's kind of a good closure to a beekeeping year formally for us in our association. The announcement has come out for the NJBA winter meeting is going to be held in February. It's going to be at the Nottingham Firehouse again. And it looks like it's going to be a compilation of topics. And I've been asked to speak there. I'm going to talk again about the follow-up year two of the New Jersey Swarm Report. And we'll also be doing a preview of the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers website and YouTube channel. That appears to be of an interest to that audience. And last but not least, the Hunterdon County Agricultural Talk that we gave last weekend was a big hit. We only had a really short duration. I was walked in and greeted by the farmer who runs that saying, "You have this much time, and if you're not done, we're going to shut you off." But it was ironic that I finished right on time, and then they asked 80 million questions because it was interesting, and of course we knew it was going to go that way. The focus of the presentation was to educate them on some basics about beekeeping and how important native and regular pollinators are and some ways that they could help us. I think we hit, and why it was interesting is it was on a number of topics that they were not familiar with. It was new information for them, and they found it really interesting. I could tell you that I rarely stand in front of an audience where I'm engaged that much with eye contact throughout. We hit them with a rapid-fire session of topics, what the fact that the bees pollinate a vast majority of our food chain and the impact throughout the ecosystem without bees showed them some visual impacts of that. We talked about the pollinators in trouble and the various topics, pesticides, lack of habitat, and other things that are impacting that. We went into a short segment where we talked to them about the practices that they follow and how it could be a partnership between us if they change some of their practices, talking about inserting pollinator rows, using less chemicals, applying by following the directions and reading them every time you apply, things like that. Some of what was covered in our pesticide brochure that's being now distributed by the NJBA. We talked about the NJBA programs that were in place for 2014 and will be in place for 2015. The plants that we gave out to encourage bee-friendly habitat and plants in the fall time especially, and the cooperation that we're trying to get with the road departments and utilities throughout the state to plant foraging materials for bees. All in all, the talk went really well. Got a lot of positive feedback as we were exiting. And ironically, this past week on Wednesday night, we had a Wednesday session executive meeting for our Beekeepers Association in the 4-H building. And as we were leaving, this same group of people were having their monthly meeting down the hall and stopped us and really thanked us for the presentation. And they apparently were just talking it about on their agenda in their meeting about how favorable it was and their key to have us back. So mission accomplished there. That's really good. If you're interested in seeing what we presented, feel free to let me know. I'm happy to share the concepts and thoughts so that you can go do this again with your local farmers if that's a path that you want to go down. So I guess that's going to bring us to close. I know that I'll be off the grid for a couple days. I'm heading to D.C. for a number of days for work this week. So I'll probably surface later in the week and see what's going on in the world and start posting some stuff over on Facebook in the in-between activities. Have a fair number of topics teed up for 71. So next weekend, if the cards play, we'll look to see if we can record that. If not, it'll probably come in the next weekend. But that's it. So once again, I thank you for coming and listening. If you made it to the end, good for you. We appreciate everybody's feedback. If you have anything you want to share with us, kevin@bkcorner.com is my email address. And I have been really diligent over the last month to answer literally every email that's come through since I've solved my email problem. So as you've heard, please feel free to write in. We'll give you a little mention if you share some stuff with us. And we always reply back, just say, how do you do? So feel free. Let us know if you're going to write in how to pronounce your name. That's really important and where you're hailing from. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. Be well.